Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Welcome. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott, and I'm here with Mark Pascal. Together, we own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to us every weekday from 11 a.m. to noon, and reach us through our website at www.restaurantguysradio.com. You can also catch us podcasting on iTunes or Podcast Alley. If you don't know how to do that, you can go to our website and find out. It's a great way that if you miss the show, it's sent directly to your computer every time you boot up, and it's a whole lot of fun. Hey there, Mark.
Hey there. We don't want anybody missing a show.
No, we don't want anybody missing a show because they're all really good.
Just because you might have to go to work or something like that, don't miss the show.
But you can have it waiting for you on your computer when you go home. And send us email at restaurantguysradio.com, Francis or Mark, Francis at restaurantguysradio.com or Mark at restaurantguysradio.com. We love to hear from you. If you're in the industry, we're hiring for our new restaurant, which is Catherine Lombardi's restaurant. We're opening in downtown New Brunswick.
And I want you to know, when you send emails to Francis at restaurantguysradio.com and you don't send it to me, it hurts my feelings.
But he's a tough guy. He can handle it. Let's talk about restaurant stories.
There are a lot of them.
I got one in the news.
Oh, I know the one you're talking about.
Dateline, Allenhurst, New Jersey. Sometimes restaurant people are stupid. And there's just no getting around it.
Unfortunately, it's
oh my
too often.
God.
So just we need to tell everybody what story we're talking about.
You want
about.
Me to read?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. The bill was a Dateline, Allenhurst, New Jersey. The bill was a shocker, and not because of the amount. After eating at a Jersey Shore restaurant, Elliot Stein and his girlfriend were handed a bill that said, and I quote, "Jew couple," near the bottom as a table identifier used by the waitstaff. The slur also turned up on Stein's credit card statement weeks later. Are you kidding me?
Okay. Number one.
Don't be rude.
Okay, number one.
Don't be...
You're a racist pig.
Absolutely.
Number two.
You're an idiot.
You're a stupid racist pig.
Thank heaven. You know, if you're going to have racist pigs, you should have stupid racist pigs. And let's call this racist pig out. We have, let's see. Oh, racial slurs are not supposed to be used to describe diners. It's against company policy. Good.
It's against
good.
Company good. Policy. Congratulations to you.
The server identified on the check was named only as Karina.
Uh-huh.
K-A-R-I-N-A. And not surprisingly, she no longer works at the restaurant.
They haven't been able to find
Karina.
Her.
Karina. Oh,
like that guy,
Lord.
Like that guy from Chicago who took the home run took the home run ball.
You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of back in the beginning. I mean, we've gone through increasing levels of professionalism in our own restaurant, but also mm-hmm. I've seen it throughout the restaurant world.
Sure.
And do you remember early on? We made the grave mistake of one of our early chefs insisted on having a radio playing the Grateful Dead in the kitchen. Do you remember?
Yes, I do remember it.
What was wrong with us that we allowed that to go on?
Well, we only allowed it in times when we weren't open, but...
But, you know, it always seeped into times when it did. And
then you're answering the phone and the Grateful Dead's in the background and it just...
Or it goes and it changed, you know, what you don't... I mean, I love the Grateful Dead. If you're growing flowers, you're making wine, you're doing something at that... But... You set the tone for your organization. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we've realized over time is if you say, well, this is acceptable when we're closed, and you let too much happen when you're closed that is unacceptable when you're open, it makes it a facade. It makes it makes it a thin veneer.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't say, well, you need to be gracious and respectful once at 5:30, but from 5:15, you can wear, you know, your concert T-shirt.
It permeates into the culture of the organization.
Absolutely,
that's exactly what happens.
And that's Jew couple. That's unacceptable.
Okay, same restaurant. Okay, yeah. as the one we were just talking about.
Uh-huh.
Someone has come forward and said, "Oh yeah, on my check it said Dirty Joanne."
Oh, and they saved the check and just didn't think it was just for their own personal reasons because they were so mad at it.
Oh, can you imagine? That's the kind of thing you post on a bulletin board.
I have to say, it happened to me once in a restaurant I worked in New Brunswick. Not our own place. I was working as a bartender, and we used to use paper checks. I mean, what happens now is we have computers that keep track of everyone's check.
Mm-hmm.
But there used to be paper checks, and if you're in the dining room, table numbers work. But if you're running a bar tab for someone, If you're in a place where they require, a lot of places require you to give a credit card, so they'll keep that paper clip to your check, and that
right.
way, you know, if you walk, they still charge your credit card. But if they don't, and it's a place where you're a regular, you as the bartender may have 9 tabs open, 10 tabs open, mm-hmm. and people move around at a bar.
Sure. So you like to have an identifying characteristic.
So you don't write, you know, seat 2, because it's a bar and people are standing up. You
man with glasses.
Man in pinstripe suit. Mm-hmm. Woman in yellow dress, you know. Well, I remember they used to write in the, on the cocktail tables of this place, there's a little part that you rip off on the top of a check.
Right, it's like a 3-part check, so the top connects all the parts.
Right, and you're supposed to rip that off and throw it away when you present the check. And so that's where we would write our table identifiers. Because mm-hmm. frankly, I don't even want a check to go to a table that says, you know,
man with glasses.
It's just,
right.
you know, a restaurant should be magic. You know, we don't need to know how we keep track of things, how I know what wine goes in mm-hmm. what glass, how I know whether you had decaf or regular. I just got to get it right. And that's part of the magic of the experience. Well, the way that we used to do it at this other place was they would write in that part of the check that gets ripped off. But it gets ripped off like 19 times out of 20. And every
right.
once in a while, it just doesn't fall off all the way. Somebody forgets. Somebody else drops the check. And I remember I stopped the check as it was about to go to somebody. Not mine. I didn't write this. Wasn't my patron, but I was the bartender. And so my job was...
I like that disclaimer you placed right on top of the story.
Oh my God,
I would never do this in a gazillion years, is what you're trying to say.
After I saw what almost happened. Because it was my responsibility to ring up the check.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the waiter handed me the check for this guy.
It's a total.
Bald, fat guy was written on the check, was written on the top, and they hadn't ripped the thing off.
Wow.
It was going down, everybody.
Wow, that's
going
to be rough.
And you know what you're not doing? I get the check, because right now, okay, I was 25 then. I was a skinny, you know, fairly good-looking bartender.
Yeah, I was just a very hairful fat guy back then.
No, see, I was even skinny back then. Now, I am a bald fat guy, and my impressions are still the same. I wouldn't want to get the check that tells me, you know? I don't need you to know.
There's $300 for my dinner, and thanks for the insult.
I don't, you know, I am a bald fat guy. I don't need you to tell me that I'm a bald fat guy. You know what I mean? Hopefully.
You're not my doctor.
Exactly. You know what else I remember? I remember we had another, speaking of crazy comments at a restaurant, I remember the time, I don't know why this brought this to mind, what you really do need to as a bartender, look at your customers, especially mm-hmm. as a bartender.
You've got to be very aware of the surroundings. Things can happen fast, things change fast. You want to be very aware of your surroundings.
And as a bartender, you get a sixth sense. Who's trouble? What's wrong? You know, mm-hmm. it's just, you've been bartending for a long time, you get in to know it. And we have an old friend of ours who was bartending for us, and she was just very nice, like mm-hmm. Midwest nice, like nice to everybody nice.
Like too nice for New Brunswick nice.
Right, like you got to cut somebody off sometime. No, you can't serve the guy with a gun, you know, that kind of
right.
thing. You know, yeah, he had a gun. He should have probably not served him, I guess. But now he's got a gun. What are you going to do?
You can't stop.
Don't take it away from him. And I remember we had this long talk with her about how she's got to be more careful and she needs to be a little more suspicious of people mm-hmm. and be nice to everybody, but keep your eyes open. And that very day, I don't know if you remember this story.
Oh, I remember it.
That very day, she went behind the bar not 10 minutes after the conversation, and it was a Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody walked into the bar on like a quiet Sunday, the only person in the restaurant, the only person in the bar. And this person, the bartender, served this man a drink.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I walked over and said, bartender girl. And she came over and I said, you know how we were talking about how you need to watch some people for signs that there might be a problem?
They might have an issue.
Yeah,
they might not be appropriate for the place.
She said, yeah. I said, see that guy over there?
Yeah, he seems nice. That's what she said. Yeah, he seems nice.
Did you notice the hospital band around his wrist? She said, oh. And did you notice that he has all of his belongings in the brown plastic bag that's next to him? And he's not wearing any socks, and it's January.
Yeah, he's wearing sandals.
We have coming up in a moment, we have an author who's written an unauthorized biography of Robert Parker, the most important restaurant critic, most important wine critic, and the most important critic of any kind in his field in the world. Very interesting stuff. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
You're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We are here today with a very special guest. A woman named Aileen McCoy is an award-winning journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Times, House and Garden, Forbes magazine. She's been a contributing editor at Food and Wine magazine. She's currently the wine and spirits columnist for Bloomberg Markets, and she's author of the controversial new biography of the most famous and controversial wine critic, Robert M. Parker. Her book is called The Emperor of Wine, The Rise of Robert M. Parker Jr. and the Reign of American Taste. Hello, Aileen. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Welcome, Aileen. I think maybe we want to start off with telling everybody just who Robert Parker is. I think a lot of our audience may not be familiar with him.
Well, Robert M. Parker Jr. is the most powerful wine critic in the world. He started in 1978 a newsletter called The Wine Advocate, and it has become the most influential newsletter and source of information about wine in the world. All over the world, people are making wines to please this one person.
Why is The Advocate so important?
It's important because the people who read it, the retailers, the importers, the wine people who are actually making wine, want very much for Robert Parker to rate their wines very, very highly. And Parker started the whole idea of rating wines on a 100-point rating system. And since if you get 95 for your wine, it will sell out within hours if it's a small amount, days. Mm-hmm. If it's more, you can see that he has a huge amount of muscle over the marketing of your wine.
He's been called, just so everyone knows, he's very important. He's been called the Alan Greenspan of the wine world because his opinions...
Because he changes interest rates.
Because his opinions matter very, very much. There's a story in your book, a wonderful story in your book, about how someone was in the room while Robert Parker was tasting wines that are in barrel that weren't finished yet. We call that tasting en premier, or tasting wines before they're finished in barrel. And Robert Parker writes reviews, as do many critics, writes reviews about what the wine is going to be like when it's bottled. Now, this is the first inkling of what his score is going to be. And you have this wonderful tale of there was someone who was in the room, and he was tasting through this one Chateau's wine, and he hit one, and he said, wow.
Right.
The person heard him say wow, called up Monsieur Tuton in Manhattan, and said, Parker said wow about wine number four. How much do you want? And he said he bought $83,000 worth of wine based on Robert Parker's wow. And it turned out to be a good decision.
Right, exactly.
Now, that is Alan Greenspan of the wine world. But the other thing is, Alan Greenspan's never unwise enough to say, wow. Because if Alan Greenspan's ever said, wow, you'd know what to buy.
Not in a room with a winemaker, anyway.
Well, actually, I love that story. I thought it was a great story, and I especially love the part where the two people, Monsieur Tuton, Guillaume Tuton in Manhattan, and this negociant in Bordeaux were arguing about, well, how enthusiastic was the wow?
Is that a capital wow or a lowercase
right.
wow?
In the book you write, that Tuton said, well, now you're sure it wasn't a whoa, but it was a wow. He's like, no, it was definitely a wow.
Exclamation point or comma. Where are we going with this wow?
And what he said was, listen, this is your crack at it. You want to buy it right now based on the wow.
Yeah.
And this, you know what? I got to say, through no fault of Robert Parker's, there's really something wrong with the world in which that's the case. Don't you think?
I absolutely agree with you. For one thing, I think one of the reasons that I even wanted to write this book is I've covered the wine industry as a writer for 30 years. And over that 30 years, I've watched Parker become more and more and more and more powerful to the point where consumers believe that somehow if they like a wine, and it didn't get a high score, that something is wrong with their taste buds.
They must be doing something wrong. They're doing it wrong.
And that upsets me. Plus the idea that the way to market wine, which, as we all know, is changing from day to day, and that it can be marketed on a single number
from
that
a single
one
rating.
Person.
Yeah.
Right.
Decides on during 1 minute of tasting seems to me a really sad commentary on just the whole idea of how much power people are willing to give an individual.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also I think that you know, if you view wine as more than just a commodity, if you view it as a maybe an art or maybe even a craft, it's like if you had one art critic in the world and he said, you know, and he gave things a numerical score. First of all, it's like if you're in the Prado Museum, and you sort of heard someone walking around saying, "Well, I gave the Velázquez a 94, but the Degas only got an 85," you'd think, "Didn't you miss something?"
Right.
Well, I agree with you. I think that one thing that also made me want to write this book is that I really believe that wine is an experience. It's not just a thing in a glass. Of course it's a thing in a glass, but, you know, we have so little in our lives anymore that isn't mediated by somebody else, you know, where we actually are tasting it ourselves. It's not a virtual experience.
Right, right.
And it just seems very sad to me that people are really unwilling a lot of times to trust their own taste, to say, I'm tasting this, I'm having this experience.
Right.
And the experience is part of the taste.
Right. Aileen, when we come back, I really want you to tell us how Parker feels about having all this power. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey. Time is 11:25.
Hey, you're back with The Restaurant Guys, and we're talking with Aileen McCoy. Aileen has written the biography of Robert Parker called The Emperor of Wine, The Rise of Robert M. Parker Jr., and The Reign of American Taste. And we were talking before the break about how what's said about how Parker has, or how the market uses Parker's score, which is the be-all and end-all, is sometimes someone will try a wine and they'll say, oh, I like that, but they'll find out that it didn't get a good Parker score, and they'll think, oh, I must be an idiot.
I got it wrong.
Whereas that's like going into a museum and you seeing a painting that you like.
Yeah, it's not a math problem.
Four
is not the answer.
There is no right answer. And I think that's a real problem, and we find that in the restaurant. But I think now there's a growing movement of people who make their name by being without regard to Robert Parker. And I think that in great restaurants, when you go into a restaurant and they sell wines and they have the list of the wine and the Robert Parker score and the price, that's how you buy commodities. That's not how you buy something to go with your dinner. I mean, do you find that there's increasing people who are defining themselves as opposed to Robert Parker, offering different opinions?
Well, yeah, I think that that's a growing factor. And I think when you look back and you see how Robert Parker started, and how in the late 70s and the 1980s, I mean, quite frankly, when you went around the country, you didn't find a sommelier in the number of restaurants where you find them now, somebody who was the wine buyer for a great restaurant.
Right.
You also didn't find so many great restaurants. You didn't find retailers and retail shops where the person who was running the retail shop actually knew something about wine. And I can remember when wine in a wine store was sort of like the corner was wine, then the rest of it was liquor.
But some of that is because of Robert Parker. People have taken an interest in wine because of his publication, not just in spite of it.
Well, I think certainly that early along when he championed really interesting importers, and he gave them he connected people with those really good importers, people like Kermit Lynch, who are bringing in really interesting wines.
There's no question that he did a service in that regard. We're talking with Aileen McCoy. We're going to talk more with Aileen McCoy about the state of wine in America. And even if you're not interested in wine, Robert Parker is the most powerful critic of any kind in any field in the world. And this is a very interesting biography about him. And a lot of people have a lot of strong opinions about this with regard to wine, but also with regard to our current state of globalization in the world overall. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott, and I'm here with Mark Pascal. Together, we own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to us every day from 11 a.m. to 12 noon, and reach us through www.restaurantguysradio.com. We're also podcasting, and you can pick us up on iTunes
or Podcast Alley
and have our show sent right to your computer every time we put a new one up on the web. Today, our very interesting guest, who's taken some time out of her very busy schedule, is Aileen McCoy. She's an award-winning journalist whose work has appeared in The New York Times, House and Garden, Forbes magazine. She's been a contributing editor at Food and Wine magazine. She's currently the wine and spirits columnist for Bloomberg Markets, and she's the author of a controversial new biography on the most famous and most controversial wine critic in the world, and indeed the most important critic of any genre at all. The book is called The Emperor of Wine, The Rise of Robert M. Parker Jr. and the Reign of American Taste, and you can find out where to get that on our website later on today. Hi, Aileen.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. We were talking before about Robert Parker's... he started in a world in which there weren't a lot of wine shops with wine-knowledgeable people, where there weren't a lot of sommeliers in restaurants in America. And when you did find a sommelier, it wasn't like you often find today, which is an eager young person who's jazzed about wine and wants to help you find a great bottle, whether it's a $10 bottle or a $100 bottle. You found a snooty French guy.
or a stuffed-shirt 60-year-old man
who really wasn't very helpful.
Who didn't want to tell you much about wine except how much he knew.
And the world needed Robert Parker, and Robert Parker has done a tremendous amount of good in the wine world, and he's received many awards because he has been very responsible for the resurgent interest. But as his power has sort of consolidated, and I don't put the blame for this at his feet, it's what our society does with those reviews, and we've made him the only critic that moves the needle, you know. But what he says goes. When he says a wine is great, it goes off the charts. If he says a wine is terrible and it's good, they'll have trouble selling it.
Aileen, how does Robert Parker feel about having all that power?
Well, Robert Parker likes to say that, you know, he never asked for this kind of power, which is absolutely true. And that he really, I mean, he has really three ideas about power. One is he doesn't really have as much as people think he does.
That's not true.
Well, that's not true. And then the other thing is that he has the power, but there isn't really very much that he can do about it. I think that's not exactly true. Mm-hmm. But I do agree that it's people who have given Bob Parker the power. You know, nobody has power unless other people give it to them.
Right. Especially in an area like this.
Especially in an area like this. And I think the thing, however, is that it's sort of hard to disentangle that power now, because really Parker not only influences the way wines are marketed by all those retailers and those winemakers who want to sell out the wine, but also he influences the way wines are made, because obviously if you make a wine that you think is the style of wine that Parker will like, you're going to be more likely to get a high score and sell out your wine. But the third way is he actually has influenced the way that we talk about wine. The language that he uses to talk about wine is now the language that people use. And that has a lot of effect.
Yeah, he's changed the lexicon, no doubt about it.
Well, and here's the deal, everybody, and here's why this is sort of disturbing. It's because a lot of people out there who spend a lot of money on wine think that if they know Robert Parker, and I know a lot of people who memorize Parker scores on everything, and they buy and drink based on the Parker scores. As a way to get into wine, not a half-bad way to do it.
No, I agree.
But once you're into wine, if you truly love wine and you don't disagree with Robert Parker 20% of the time, then there's a problem. Then
right.
You don't really have your own palate. And why this is affecting the wine world in such a negative way is people who made very beautiful wines that weren't the kind of wines that Robert Parker likes. Like you quote importer Joe Dressner, who likes, you know, lighter style but very beautiful, like Loire Valley reds. And I know Joe, and I like his wines a lot.
Me too.
And he writes, or you quote him in your book, you say, Parker won't concede or delineate his limitations. He still thinks of himself as a consumer advocate, but he's gone from pointing out bad wines to becoming the proponent of a particular wine style. It's almost like a theater critic only likes Shakespeare, and therefore other sorts of plays weren't being produced. And I think the problem is when you only go with one critic, you do have a problem. But I'll tell you something else. And you point out in your book a lot of people who are sort of reacting against Parker, and even people, and I think their anger at Parker is misplaced.
Mm-hmm.
but people who are sort of becoming the anti-Parker, the champions of the other kinds of wine. And it's nascent and it's small right now.
But the world has changed to be more like Parker's palate. And I don't know if that's a good thing. We've lost some diversity.
I think things are changing in the following way. I mean, obviously, I didn't go into this in my book because, you know, this is a book about Bob Parker, not about what's going to happen after Bob Parker retires or
right.
whatever. But I do think that there's a shift because of the internet and because of how people get their opinions today because of the internet. And also there's a younger generation coming along that have grown up in a world where wine was on tables in restaurants.
Right.
And they have their own ideas, and they're not so influenced, I think, by experts.
I don't know. I hope you're right, but I don't see that. I see the young people especially being very influenced by not only the Parker scores, but that people now equate, I mean, and Robert Parker generally likes, and a lot of his critics say, oh, he only likes one style of wine. That's not true. But his palate does tend toward really powerful wines.
Yeah,
and,
I agree. Mm-hmm.
And the wines that he doesn't like, you know, a young kid says, oh, that's terrible. I don't like
right.
that. I'm going
to
see that.
It's, I mean, we have to face that a lot of our society is interested in statistics. And you want to know how many home runs somebody hit, and you want to know how many points your Parker wine got.
Yeah, this is true. I agree that that's true, and I don't know. It's an interesting question why Americans are so in love with statistics and numbers of all kinds.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, I also think that the other thing, though, that's very compelling about Parker, and this is another reason why I was really interested in writing the story of Parker's rise, is that it's a very compelling American story. You can't imagine anybody in France being able to do what Parker did,
mm-hmm.
Or England or anywhere, because this is the land where you can go from drinking soda or coming out of nowhere and follow your passion and then succeed beyond your wildest dreams.
Yeah.
That's like an American myth. And early along, Parker liked to characterize himself as a lone ranger.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about that whole image and that whole idea of him that captured people at the beginning. And I think that story still captures a lot of people. I think it's what makes the story of Parker accessible, actually, to people that aren't even, you know, complete wine buffs.
I think what's interesting about it is it's both sides of that American story. Here you have, you know, when he started, there were a lot of people foisting plonk on Americans because they rested on the laurels of the prestige of their house, and they would look mm-hmm. down anyone's nose who called their plonk plonk and said, oh, well, then you don't know what the good wine is. You know, and Parker said, oh, yeah,
Francis has a bent against the French, and
no,
it seems to be coming out
no,
to
I
that.
Don't. But then Parker would say, no, your wine stinks. I give it 80 points. What do you think of that, French boy? And
he was more polite than that.
When you get an 85, that's what he means.
Okay. Yeah.
He may not say it, but that's what he means. And the net result is just the same. But also, he was a consumer advocate.
Yes.
And that was important, and that's still important to a certain sense. But now, it's like Dressner says, now it's like the guy who has, you know, he becomes the authority on everything. So we say, you know, as Americans, sometimes I think we tend to walk in like a bull in a china shop, correct some things that are wrong, but then sometimes we can say, and our way is the right way, and we become the new hegemony, you know?
I agree. I think that's absolutely true. And in the conclusion of my book, I have to say that I really feel that in many ways Parker is so completely American.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that, I mean, there are many good things that America has done and a lot of ideals that are not always realized, unfortunately, as we well know. But I think that's that certainty that you're talking about, the
right.
certainty that you're right.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that offends people.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's sometimes it can actually do some damage. And we'll talk mm-hmm. about some things that may be being lost and some things that may be being changed that maybe shouldn't be when we come back in a moment. Our guest is Aileen McCoy. She's written The Emperor of Wine, The Rise of Robert M. Parker Jr., the most powerful wine critic in the world. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. You're back with The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis here, and our guest today is Ellen McCoy, or Aileen McCoy. Sorry, she is an award-winning journalist who's written a new book called The Emperor of Wine, a very controversial book about the rise of Robert M. Parker Jr., who is the most important wine critic in the world and the most powerful critic of any genre of anything in the world. He's the one that matters most in wine, and it's very controversial how he's come about. In fact, one of the things we're talking about is how the wine world is changing to suit his taste, because if Robert Parker gives you a 95, you get to sell all your wine, double the price, and buy a Maserati. If Robert Parker gives your wine an 82, it can be the best wine in the world, but
You're selling it as the next $3 Chuck.
You better be thirsty, is what I'm thinking. And how that's changed the world is you now have companies out there. There's a company named Enologics.
Oh, yeah.
Which is trying to calibrate exactly what Robert Parker's preferences are, and people are making their wine, changing the way they make their wine to suit Robert Parker's palate. And
which is actually a testament to him, because what they're saying is this guy is so consistent and so accurate that we can guess how he's going to rate a wine.
But what it does is instead of wines from different places trying to be expressive of those different places, wines from all different places start to please Robert Parker. And actually, because Robert Parker tastes the wine sometimes before they're made in Bordeaux in what's called en premier in March, which is well before the wines are finished, there is evidence that winemakers are designing their wines to taste better in barrel when Parker is there tasting them, which has nothing to do with what they're going to be like in the bottle when you have them. And they may even give up a little bit of what's in the bottle to have a better en premier tasting with Robert Parker, which is very, very disturbing. Don't you find, Aileen?
Well, I find it disturbing that people would be trying to make wines to please one person.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that I think to be fair, one has to say that there's a group of people that have a huge stake in getting a high score.
Sure.
Those are people who have just started a winery. I mean, or people who owe a lot of money to the bank and need to be able to sell out quickly.
So mm-hmm. Almost everybody in the restaurant business, you know.
Well, but also I think that there are people who don't have to do that. And I think that the influence of Parker, for the most part, is while there are people who are trying to make wine to please Robert Parker deliberately, his impact is almost more general than that. It's sort of like people say to themselves, you know, wines that have a lot of fruit in them and are really big and have, like, higher alcohol seem to get higher scores, so maybe I should nudge up the fruit and the alcohol in my wine a little bit.
Yeah.
It's not like they're doing it, they're crafting a wine specifically for Parker. They sort of see Parker as what the American marketplace is.
Representative of what Americans are looking for.
But, you know, it's funny. I looked at the Consumer Reports. Are you familiar with the publication Consumer Reports?
Oh, sure.
Every senior citizen in America has Consumer Reports. My father calls me every week and tells me what I need to buy. Now, look, if you're buying a toaster, you're buying a Volkswagen, Consumer Reports, get it. It's great. It gives you, like, the values and what things should cost and how good the tires are. And the Consumer Reports came out last year with their wine buying guide. And something about that I thought was very incongruous. It's like the Consumer Reports guide to fine art, you know, or to opera, you know? And I thought to myself two things. I thought, one, Consumer Reports shouldn't be what you buy the finer things in life with, because it doesn't get the subtlety, the nuance, the difference in taste. You know, it's not a commodity that
an economic curve.
And the other thing that I thought of was that, in a way, that's what the Parker scores already do. Why do I need Consumer Reports? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, actually, I agree with you. I think the Consumer Reports thing for wine does not make sense at all, because, quite honestly, it's one thing if you're going to buy, I don't know, a toaster. I mean, you know, you have a certain number of criteria that you have for a toaster.
Right.
Like, you know, it toasts it quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, it pops up and makes a noise, so it's
durable.
Not sitting there.
Yeah.
It look, you know. So,
right, you can get 722 uses from each toaster.
Right, exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. And so
it's quantifiable.
It's very quantifiable. But the whole world of wine is completely diverse, and what you actually want out of wine sort of depends upon when you want to drink it.
And,
I mean, if you are going to the beach and you're having a big beach party, mm-hmm. I personally would rather have, you know, a $10 really great, you know, fun rosé
right.
than I would have a bottle of Chateau Margaux.
Not to mention that wine is a living, breathing thing that changes every moment.
Yeah, and I have a great quote that I really love in my book, that the late Louis Martini, the winemaker in the Napa Valley, once told me, which is, the wet laboratory of your mouth is not always the same. You know, you get up in the morning, you make your coffee, you have the same water, you have the same coffee pot, you have the same coffee, and the wine and the coffee tastes different to you. Well, that's because it's your mouth.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's because, you know, what you're tasting that particular day, maybe you have a cold, maybe,
right.
You know, you got up on the wrong side of the bed, who knows. But in any case, I think that what makes me very sad, and what I'm very interested, the reason I'm interested in wine is because it gives me a window into an experience and a person and a place.
Uh-huh.
And we have so few of those possibilities left to us. You know, you buy something, it's made in a factory, it doesn't give you any connection with another person.
And that is what wine is all about. Our guest today is Aileen McCoy. She is the author of The Emperor of Wine, The Rise of Robert M. Parker Jr., a biography. And we'll be talking more with her in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. You're back with The Restaurant Guys. Today our guest is Aileen McCoy, an award-winning journalist who has just come out with the very controversial book on Robert M. Parker, the most powerful wine critic in the world and the most powerful critic of any kind. And we're going to link you to, if you go to our website later on, restaurantguysradio.com, you can find out where to get the book, and we really recommend it. It's important, even if you're not a wine lover, it's an important book.
Aileen, one last question. How does Parker feel about this book?
I really don't know, because he has not communicated with me.
That's a good sign.
Because he stopped talking to you? Is that why?
Well, I don't know. I hear that I know that he has said on his website that he's not going to comment on the book. So I don't know what he thinks about the book. I hope he thinks it's fair, because I think there's a lot that's good about
If you were him, how would you feel about the book?
I think it's very hard to have someone write a book about you unless it's your mother.
And your mother's book would be so boring no one would buy it because she
likes
you. Well,
that's probably true.
Hey, listen, Aileen, we want to thank you for taking the time out of your schedule to talk to us about your new book.
Hey, and Aileen, do me a favor.
Yes.
Don't tell Robert Parker this, but I love when we disagree on a wine because I get to strike up a debate with one of my customers and turn them on to something new.
Absolutely.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks, Aileen. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye. You know, it's funny. That's part of what we do, I think, I think Barbara Parker's got a great palate, but I disagree with him about 20% of the time.
Yep.
And you know what? When you disagree with Robert Parker, you get a bargain on your wine.
That's right. You get a bargain, and you get a story and something to talk about. And if you turn somebody onto a wine that where you disagree with Parker, now all of a sudden
you have
people
credibility,
trust you.
You
exactly.
have a friend. And you know, I think that's what we do, though, because wine is a living thing. And Robert Parker does the best he can, and he gets it right a lot. But there are certain wines he doesn't like that are great, and there are certain times he just gets it wrong. He revises his own score sometimes.
Absolutely.
He knows he's not perfect. And when you go to a restaurant or a wine shop, if you find the guy, the person, the man or woman who's the sommelier or the wine shop person, and you say, I'd like a great wine that's like this, and they say, oh, this got 95 from Robert Parker.
The most important, right.
You can read the magazine yourself. You don't
Absolutely.
Need that. They're not a professional.
The most important thing you want from a person who's selling you wine is you want them to understand what you want.
And they understand the wine without having read a Robert Parker. Anybody can read Robert Parker and tell you what the scores are. And there are a lot of people like that out there. There are a lot of young people in this industry that are really jazzed about it in restaurants and wine shops. And we encourage you to go out there and look them up. And we encourage you to pick up this book, The Emperor of Wine, The Rise of Robert M. Parker and The Reign of the American Taste by Aileen McCoy. And you can find out more on our website. I am Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.